Good evening. I'm Bernie McNamee.
And I'm Martina Fitzgerald. This is The World at 6 from CBC National Radio News.
In the news tonight, more adventure than advertised. A cruise to the Antarctic goes awry, but the cruise company says everyone is safe.
Canada in the spotlight over climate change at the Commonwealth Summit.
And it's football fever in Toronto. It's a prairie party as Saskatchewan takes on Winnipeg in the Grey Cup.
This polar cruise may have been a little more extreme than most of the passengers had in mind. Off the coast of Antarctica, their ship, run by the Toronto-based travel company Gap Adventures, smashed into some underwater ice and started sinking. As Philip Lee Shannock tells us, all 154 passengers are safe and sound.
They was a little bit cold and wet, but in good conditions.
Captain Arnvid Hansen of the Norwegian ship Nord Norge is more than happy to accommodate his unexpected guests.
We have brought them aboard, bringing them warm clothes and food and accommodations, so they are in good mood now.
Last night, a Canadian-owned cruise ship collided with submerged ice in the Bransfield Strait. The Explorer began taking on water through a hole the size of a fist. Passengers and crew spent about 6 hours in lifeboats in the freezing waters off Antarctica before they were rescued. Staff members from the company's Toronto head office were aboard at the time. They were able to get an email message to Gap Adventures marketing director Susan Hayes.
Just, you know, we're fine. Everybody's in good spirits. Don't worry. We're all good. We've been in contact with our families.
The Explorer is a 38-year-old ship built specifically to take tourists on polar expeditions. Gap Adventures CEO Bruce Poontip says the ship is one of the smallest to cruise Antarctic waters.
Because it is so small, and because we take such few passengers, we can maneuver much easier in polar waters, and we're able to do a lot more. And I mean, that's why people travel with us.
As for the Explorer's passengers, they'll soon be on dry land and then headed for home. The trip of a lifetime cut short, and perhaps more adventure than they bargained for. Philip Lee Shannock, CBC News, Toronto.
Canada's position on climate change is coming under scrutiny at the meeting of Commonwealth Nations in Uganda. The 53-member group is said to be close to passing a resolution calling for binding targets for reducing harmful emissions. But some delegates say privately Canada's insistence that the same targets apply to all countries is proving to be an obstacle to any agreement. The CBC's James Cudmore has more from Kampala.
The Commonwealth Summit officially kicked off with music and dancing and speeches.
One of the biggest challenges that we all face, climate change.
Lawrence Gonzi is the Prime Minister of Malta. The small island nation has a huge interest in global warming. If it causes the world's seas to rise, Malta will essentially sink. Malta is lobbying for significant and binding commitments to reduce greenhouse gases.
The challenge of climate change not only requires a united front, but an unprecedented level of cooperation and firm action.
Canada agrees, but only to a point, and that's turning into an issue in the back rooms of the summit. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, in particular, is hoping for a strong Commonwealth consensus on climate change before the conference ends. But sources close to the discussion say Canada and Prime Minister Stephen Harper, in particular, are stumbling blocks to the Commonwealth presenting a united front.
I'm not going to name names.
Commonwealth Secretary General Don MacKinnon says there is a gap between some countries and the issue is those binding commitments.
There's some quite a tough few words there that, you know, some countries may not wish to buy on as expressly or strongly as other ones do.
The Prime Minister's office says Harper did address the issue, but only to assert his government's long-held position that any further move on climate change has to include every country and to take into account their national circumstances. James Cudmore, CBC News, Kampala.
And here in Canada, there was a blunt warning for business today on climate change. Not dealing with it will be bad for business. The warning comes from a leading expert who adds now is the time to prepare for dramatic cuts in carbon emissions. The tough talk came during a panel discussion about the business of climate change today in the province, which is the hub of Canada's oil industry. The CBC's Brooks DeCilia has the story from Lake Louise, Alberta.
Water flows quickly out of one of Canada's most iconic lakes into this creek. Nearby, tourists pose for pictures in front of Lake Louise and the imposing mountains that surround it. Picture perfect. And perhaps the perfect place for a discussion about protecting the environment. Nearby, inside the castle-like Chateau Lake Louise, hundreds of business leaders from around the world are meeting to talk about climate change. Leading expert David Keith warns dramatic changes to the environment and the economy are likely, and business needs to start planning now.
And investment in that as a risk management strategy will reduce the chance that we really have major job losses as a consequence of this for Canadians.
The federal Conservative government has high hopes technology will be a major part of any fix to the climate change problem. And Industry Minister Jim Prentice challenged business leaders here to invest more money in research and development.
There is no reason, my friends, no reason whatsoever that in Canada, specifically here in Alberta, that we should not be the leaders in scientific research in energy.
But moments later, a reality check of sorts. CIBC World Markets chief economist Jeff Rubin pointing out technology has made automobiles and household gadgets more energy efficient, but the world's thirst for energy still seems insatiable.
Unless we can prevent consumers from consuming those efficiency gains and ever greater energy usage, then, ladies and gentlemen, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
A blunt and stark reminder, no doubt, from one of Canada's leading economists that dealing effectively with climate change won't be easy. Brooks DeCilia, CBC News, Lake Louise, Alberta.
Coming up, researchers in Montreal are trying to unravel a medical mystery, the number of Canadian football players who developed Lou Gehrig's disease.
I don't think there's ever been more than 15,000 CFL football players in the history of the game. So you have 8 in 15,000, and so that's a very high percentage.
That story from Teddy Katz later on The World at 6.
The German-Canadian businessman Karl-Heinz Schreiber is well known for his controversial business dealings with Brian Mulroney. A public inquiry has been called into allegations that Mulroney agreed to receive $300,000 in cash payments from Schreiber just days before he stepped down as prime minister. But Mulroney wasn't Schreiber's only political friend in Canada. Margot Kelly has this report on Schreiber's ties to federal cabinet ministers of different political stripes and eras.
It is, I think, a great pleasure to have friends. They came here to get me out.
Karl-Heinz Schreiber leaves a Toronto courthouse in September 1999 after getting bail. Germany wants Canada to extradite him for failing to pay taxes on commissions, including millions he received for negotiating the sale of Airbus planes to Air Canada. His friends, who have signed bail guarantees for $100,000 each, are Marc Lalonde, his business lawyer and a former Liberal cabinet minister, and Elmer McKay, a former Conservative cabinet minister. At the time, McKay had been his friend for more than 15 years, back to when Schreiber was involved in funding a Dump Joe Clark movement that saw Brian Mulroney become the new Conservative leader. Outside the court, McKay spoke glowingly about Schreiber.
Well, I have a lot of respect for Mr. Schreiber. He's an unusual person. I am not aware of all of the allegations against him, but I know he's...
Not aware, even though Elmer McKay turned up in Europe a couple of months earlier to help Schreiber at a critical moment.
In May 1999, the entire German Schreiber investigation explodes.
John Goetz is a journalist with the German magazine Der Spiegel. He's followed the scandal on both sides of the Atlantic.
On May 6th, two of Germany's most important executives of the top weapons manufacturer of the whole country, called Thyssen Industries, get arrested for having been involved in a bribery and kickback scheme together with Karl-Heinz Schreiber. All hell breaks loose, and the next day, Elmer McKay flies to Switzerland and actually buys a ticket for Schreiber to fly to Canada. Schreiber had fled to Switzerland after the investigation opened. He was, so to speak, a fugitive from justice.
Upon arrival in Toronto, McKay takes Schreiber to his country retreat in Nova Scotia and loans him a car and a cell phone. A week later, Elmer's son, Peter McKay, now the MP for the riding once held by his father, stands in Parliament and tears a strip off the Liberals.
The RCMP continue to waste taxpayers' dollars on the Airbus investigation that to date has found no evidence, not a shred. When will the Solicitor General take responsibility for the RCMP and put an end to this continuous embarrassment and focus on solving real crime, not settling liberal vendettas?
It wasn't known at the time that Peter McKay had worked as an intern for Thyssen in Germany just a few years earlier. Now, McKay is the Minister of Defense, and liberals are making political hay of his family's connection to Schreiber. MP Ugel Desange.
Mr. Speaker, many members of this government have been friends and confidants of Brian Mulroney for decades. The defense minister owed one of his first jobs to Mr. Schreiber.
A spokesperson for Peter McKay isn't talking about how he got the job at Thyssen, but says McKay didn't meet Schreiber until 1995, 3 years after he took the job. There's never been any suggestion that either of the McKays received money from Schreiber. Elmer, a Nova Scotia MP, was a big supporter of Schreiber's plan to have Thyssen build a plant to manufacture light armored vehicles in Cape Breton, a plan that died under Brian Mulroney. 8 years ago, when Schreiber started his long fight to avoid extradition to Germany, he was grateful that Elmer McKay and Mark Lalonde stood by him.
And I will never let a friend down. I will never do anything to harm them. That's number one.
Elmer McKay isn't talking to reporters today about Schreiber. Mark Lalonde, his former lawyer and a former Liberal cabinet minister, says he'd sign another bail guarantee for Schreiber if need be. Lalonde told CBC News, "He hasn't cost me a penny yet." Margot Kelly, CBC News, Toronto.
Polls are now open in Australia, where voters will decide the fate of Prime Minister John Howard. The 68-year-old leader of the Conservative Liberal Party is seeking his fifth term in office. He was first elected 11 years ago, but polls have him trailing Labour Party leader Kevin Rudd, a 50-year-old former diplomat who is fluent in Mandarin. The six-week campaign has focused on which candidate can best manage Australia's booming economy and on Howard's strong support for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Jeff Elwan reports.
Australia's Prime Minister John Howard got a big hug from a shopping mall Santa Claus yesterday. The Prime Minister quipped to reporters he'd soon find out if he's been a good boy. Judgment Day has now arrived in Australia, and voters are already casting their ballots. For weeks, Howard has been trailing the new kid on the Australian political bloc, Kevin Rudd. But yesterday, Howard was buoyed by word of a slight surge in his favor in the opinion polls, and he was out vigorously hustling votes in local malls, accompanied by a slightly skeptical press corps.
I don't think it's desperate to spend the last day or the last 24 hours of the campaign in Queensland, which I've done.
Rudd, who is still widely expected to win, reacted to the news of the poll surge by Howard with caution.
We're above the snow line, and there's a peak up there somewhere, and there's still some fog and some mist around, and I know there's another bloke climbing on the other side, and this will be very tight.
Rudd is the somewhat unlikely leader of the Australian Labour Party. The Mandarin-speaking ex-diplomat has managed to curb the internal bickering in the Labour Party and rein in the union bosses, who have influenced the party over the years and scared off a lot of small business and middle-class voters. There have been a smorgasbord of issues in this campaign, including health care, education, and immigration. But at the root, the question has been, is John Howard too old at 68, and is his government too tired after more than a decade in office to deserve another term? Jeff Elwan, CBC News, Adelaide.
Lebanon is a country in political crisis. No one is certain what will happen next. As of tonight, Lebanon has no president. That is the spokesperson for outgoing President Emil Lahoud. He's saying the country is in a state of emergency, but the pro-Western prime minister has rejected that declaration. Fouad Senora says the president cannot declare a state of emergency without approval from parliament. Lebanon's parliament tried earlier today to convene to vote on a new president, but the opposition boycotted proceedings. A new session is scheduled for a week today.
On the financial markets, Toronto and New York ended the week with some strong gains. Led by resource and energy stocks, the TSX jumped 86 points to 13,467. In New York, bank stocks led the way, pushing the Dow Jones 181 points higher to 12,980. The Nasdaq was up 34 points at 2596, and the loonie fell half a cent to just over $1.01 US.
And now to How May I Help You? This week, we've been examining the state of customer service in Canada. CBC News released a survey focusing on which companies offer the best service on the telephone. Today, a report from Derek Stoffel with a look at both ends of those phone calls.
Flight Center at Carleton, this is Debbie.
Customer service is a major industry in Canada.
How can I help you? Bangkok, that's great.
There are tens of millions of phone calls every month to customer service lines in Canada. On the other end of the phone, the customer service representatives. Companies know it takes good people if they want to provide good service, so training is key. Some companies put their representatives through 6 weeks of training and orientation. Jean Mitchell of the BC Contact Center Association says there's lots for a new customer service representative to prepare for.
They're doing a complex job that requires looking at technology, mastering several multitasking options, in turn of really trying to help a customer.
Many representatives are coached on how to deal with irate callers. But Carol Cooper, a vice president at the Travel Service Flight Center, says it's unfortunate that they have to offer that training.
We treat our consultants with respect, and we do expect other people to treat us with respect, and our consultants to treat our customers with respect. I really don't like it when customers scream at our consultants because, you know, it makes it hard.
Bruce Cran doesn't condone yelling at a representative, but as the president of the Consumers Association of Canada, he understands where the frustration is coming from. Cran says customer service in Canada just isn't good enough.
Keep complaining. Canadians are fairly complacent. Canadians are much more accepting of what exists, and I think these big companies take advantage of that.
Cran has some advice. If you can't get service on the phone, write an email or consider that most Canadian of options, write a letter. Derek Stoffel, CBC News, Toronto.
The lead prosecutor at the Robert William Picton murder trial admits his key witnesses are not Rhodes Scholars, but Mike Petrie is telling the jury that doesn't mean they should throw out their testimony. Petrie is in the second day of closing arguments in the trial of the accused serial killer. Picton is charged with murdering 26 women. This trial deals with six counts. Kelly Ryan is covering the proceedings, and a warning, you may find some of the material disturbing.
It's an emotional scene outside the courthouse where Picton is standing trial. Victim Georgina Pappin's three sisters stand listening to native drummers crying on each other's shoulder. Rick Frey, father to victim Marnie Frey, stands watching nearby. He says he's feeling a bit better about the case today.
When the defense was making their submission, it was like being on a roller coaster, kind of going downhill. Now I think we've hit the bottom and we're on the upswing.
His encouragement comes from the performance of Crown Prosecutor Mike Petrie. In an unusual beginning, Petrie admitted to the jury his key witnesses are unsavory, but added that's no reason to throw out their testimony. He reminded the court when they'd been right. Scott Chubb told police there were illegal guns on the property. There were. He also said Picton told him a good way to kill prostitutes is with a syringe filled with windshield washer fluid. One such syringe was found in Picton's home. Petrie went on to discuss Lynn Ellingson. Long before any butchered remains were found on the farm, she told police she'd seen the body of a prostitute hanging in the farm's slaughterhouse, and Picton cutting her up. Petrie turned to the jury incredulously. Is that just a lucky guess? He said. Petrie also ran through all the evidence that was found in Picton's bedroom. Clothing, makeup, and jewelry belonging to four of the victims, Serena Abbotsway, Mona Wilson, Andrea Josbury, and Brenda Wolfe. The defense linked these items to Picton's friend Dinah Taylor, saying they were mixed in with her belongings and had her DNA on them. They even referred to them as Dinah's trophies. But the Crown reminded the jury, this is Mr. Picton's bedroom, calling him the magnet for all the people who came to the farm. Kelly Ryan, CBC News, New Westminster, BC.
This is The World at 6 on CBC Radio 1, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, around the world on Radio Canada International, and on the Internet at cbc.ca/w6 or /podcasting.
American sprinter Marion Jones has been disqualified from all competitions she participated in since September 2000. That includes the Sydney Olympics, where she won 5 medals. The International Association of Athletics Federations made the ruling today. Last month, Jones admitted that she used steroids from September 2000 to July 2001.
Thousands of fans are pouring into Toronto for two big football events. The Vanier Cup, the Canadian University Championship game, is underway. It is late in the first quarter, with St. Mary's leading Manitoba 7-3. Also on Sunday, there's the culmination of the Canadian Football League season, the Grey Cup game. We'll talk to some of those fans in a few minutes. First, we bring you a report on medical research linked to football. As Teddy Katz reports, there appears to be an unusually high number of former Canadian Football League players who've developed Lou Gehrig's disease.
I have to make note, Alain Kachema was very disciplined on the play. The Arrows tried to get Bishop outside in the open.
Tony Proudfoot has trouble getting his words out as a radio broadcaster for the Montreal Alouettes. The muscles in his mouth have tightened because of a deadly neurological disease. The former Canadian Football League All-Star player was diagnosed with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, last May. The news was devastating for Proudfoot, but it spurred him to do some research. A former roommate on the Montreal Alouettes died of ALS a few years before. Strange, he thought, because ALS is estimated to affect about 2 people in every 100,000. That's when Proudfoot discovered a handful of other CFL players with it.
If you have 7 people... I don't think there's ever been more than 15,000 CFL football players in the history of the game. So you have 8 in 15,000. It's much different than 1 or 2 in 100,000. And so that's a very high percentage.
Researchers in Montreal are trying to see what these athletes may have in common. Dr. Angela Genge has begun an epidemiological study that will attempt to find some answers. Genge runs the ALS clinic in Montreal. Her investigation is examining athletes in different sports and why some, like Proudfoot, have been affected.
What he's pointed to is exactly right. It may not be football. It may be something particular about what these guys took as supplements, did during their training, kind of training they did. It may have been some other factor that we can't see yet.
It's not the first time doctors have noticed what appears to be a high incidence of ALS in certain groups. Dr. Genge says it's happened to veterans returning from the first Gulf War in Iraq. And there have also been some cases in the National Football League. And in Italy, researchers there have found the incidence among professional soccer players 6 times higher than the general population.
6 volte di più che nella popolazione generale.
Raffaele Guarignello is one of the people behind the study in Italy. He says this is the first he's heard of the cases in Canada with football players. He says it's very important, and he'd like to discuss his findings with researchers in Canada. In Italy, they have theories as to why athletes are getting the disease, things like head trauma, drugs, and pesticides on the fields. The widow of a former CFL star who died of ALS is watching all this closely.
People always say to me, you know, geez, so you survived ALS, you cared for your husband, you know, you went on, you became deputy mayor of Halifax. What's my biggest failure? Well, I can save 1,000 constituents a day, but I couldn't save my husband.
Sue Utek's husband, Larry, died 5 years ago from ALS. He was Tony Proudfoot's teammate in the 1970s on the Montreal Alouettes.
Well, we hope it isn't broken for Tony's sake and the Alouettes' sake. He does a good job in there with Utek.
Well, now, Utek's taken out now. He's been shaken up of the play. We'll get back
with... Utek says a few years ago, when she asked if something from her husband's football career could have caused the disease, doctors were quick to dismiss it.
I truly believe it's got validity. You look at Tony and Larry, how interesting that two defensive backs that were former teammates and roommates could come down with ALS and both known for their hard-hitting style. And Larry had to retire from the CFL due to crushed vertebrae in his neck.
No good. Intended for Bell. The ball slipped through his hands. Tony Proudfoot hit him the moment that it got there.
Tony Proudfoot played 9 seasons in the CFL. He had a handful of concussions as a player. Now he has problems swallowing at times and isn't sure how quickly the disease will progress to other parts of his body. The investigation is expected to take at least a year or more. But Proudfoot still holds out hope he'll see some of the benefits.
I really am quite excited about pushing on this button that might lead closer to a cure, or at least understand the cause of the disease. I have a vested interest in doing a good job at this.
Teddy Katz, CBC News, Montreal.
Well, it is a big football weekend in Toronto, as we said. The top two university teams in the country are meeting tonight for the Vanier Cup. For the first time in 37 years, the Manitoba Bisons are in the final, and they're meeting the St. Mary's Huskies of Halifax. Then on Sunday, it's the 95th Grey Cup, and it's a prairie showdown this year with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers facing the Saskatchewan Roughriders. The fans have been arriving all week, and earlier today, we hit the streets for a taste of the football festivities.
All right, let me guess. You got this green outfit on. You're covered in green. Burn green, live green, die green. So you got to be from Winnipeg.
Close. Calgary.
But you're cheering for Saskatchewan, obviously.
Yeah. I'm originally from Carlisle, Saskatchewan. You can take the boy out of the prairie. You can't take the prairie out of the boy.
Oh, we've obviously run into some Rough Rider fans. There seem to be more Rough Rider fans than fans from Winnipeg, and Regina's further away.
Everybody's a Rough Rider fan.
So you guys having a good time?
Awesome. It is awesome here.
Slight possibility that Winnipeg could take it?
Not at all.
You just looked at me like you wanted to kill me. So what's happening around here?
Chicks and bikinis over there. Okay. That's all we spotted so far.
Party, are you having a good party?
Oh, excellent.
We're going to paint the town green.
You don't mind the minus 8-degree weather?
No, heck.
It's mild.
Let's go, Bombers.
Can't believe we've run into some Winnipeg fans. You guys seem to be outnumbered big time. What's going on?
Well, we wandered down here to find enemy territory here and have some fun, have a cold one. But
are you having a good time?
Yeah, so far we certainly are.
Hey, you were just outnumbered by all the Saskatchewan fans. You've got to see 1, 2, 3, 4.
They multiply with each other.
Right now, I just want to ask you, you come all the way, thousands of kilometers, spending thousands of dollars, I'm sure, when you could be at home watching it on TV. Why?
Because this is our sixth one or fifth one in a row. We do it every year. Got to support the blue and gold.
How's Toronto treating you?
Very good, actually. We've had a lot of fun here.
Everybody's saying Saskatchewan are the favorites. What do you say to that?
They're delusional. Winnipeg's going to destroy them.
Bombers! Let's go, Bombers! Let's go, Bombers! That's the color. Football is the game. We're all together. And winning is our aim. So cheer us up through the sun and rain. Saskatchewan Rough Riders is our name.
So, Martina, everybody's having a good time leading up to the big game on Sunday. And, boy, those Saskatchewan fans, are they boisterous?
It's great. We were just saying off air, though, it's funny that you didn't find more Manitoba fans around.
It was truly amazing. I don't know. They must have been hiding or something. Anyway, stay tuned to CBC and CBC.ca all weekend for Grey Cup coverage leading up to the big game Sunday night. And that will be at 4 Mountain Time.
We'll be watching. And now to sum up, all 154 passengers from a ship that hit ice in the Antarctic Ocean and began to sink are safe. The Explorer is operated by Toronto-based Gap Adventures.
Canada's stand on climate change is in the spotlight at a Commonwealth meeting in Uganda. Sources say Canada is insisting that any binding targets apply to all countries, and the other nations do not agree that they should be treated the same.
The Crown is spending a second day summing up the case against Robert William Picton. The pig farmer from Port Coquitlam, B.C. is on trial for killing six women. And that's it for Friday, November 23rd.
The World at 6. From CBC National Radio News, I'm Bernie McNamee.
And I'm Martina Fitzgerald. Good night.